views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. You know, with the world being as difficult as it is with the ongoing wars year after year after year, even if we don't have a major war, we're still in wars all over the place. Veterans committing suicide at levels not seen ever in history. Our debt being out of control. Our healthcare being a mess. Being in jobs that we might not like and that we don't agree with the people we're working with and needing to keep the job and not get fired because we just don't agree with the philosophy of the people that we're working with. Or maybe we're a leader and we're cruising along and we just can't get everybody to get on board. Whatever causes the stress that you're dealing with and the issues that you see every day. You know, the Pizzagate stuff that I'm reporting on, that is a mess. Well, all of these things that are happening around us will likely cause stress and are great triggers for not helping us maintain a happy life. And my next guest, Susan Ritchie, she's going to come on and talk about what it takes to be successful, but she's going to talk about happiness and the keys to that and why it's so important as a foundation to be able to make sure that you are happy, that you can deal with your own stuff first so that you can be better for the people around you and that you can make a difference. And how do you work on yourself to be happy? And I know this might seem like a cheesy episode because we're talking about it, but it's not. It's absolutely critical for you to make a difference in your family and in your work and in everything around you. And for you to be successful is for you to be happy first. She has a book called Strategies for Being Brilliant, 21 Ways to Be Happy, Confident, and Successful. But she's going to talk about what those core fundamental things are to be able to be that way and what that means. And it's so important. If we want to make a difference in this world, if we want to have a balanced, happy family, we need to be that ourselves. So we're going to dive into this with Susan Ritchie. But before we get into that, I want to remind you, I aired the first part of my Pizzagate reality of our child welfare system last Wednesday. And I'm going to have our next episode this coming Wednesday. And I'm going to have FBI spokesman Jeffrey Van Ness is going to come on and he's going to talk about what they're doing in with children and sexual abuse and the cases. Please tune in then. Please let your friends know. Share the other episode that I have that I put out there. If you go and you listen to my podcast or my YouTube channel, please share that because it's really important that people realize how much of an epidemic we have in this country when it comes to our child welfare system and abuse in general. So let's get on with Susan Ritchie. Hello, Sue. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Lovely of you to have me on.
Yeah, excellent. I'm glad I've heard so many good things about you. And you have this new book called Strategies for Being Brilliant, 21 Ways to Be Happy, Confident, and Successful. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that. But one of the things you state right away in it is learn how to be happy. And I want to talk about, you know, without getting corny,
yes,
you know, without being corny, but it really is a foundation for doing anything well is learning how to be happy. It's not something that you just automatically are, right? I mean, why is it so important and how do you get there?
Well, you know, I think it's vitally important, both in our personal lives and our professional lives, Sarah. You know, if we're not happy at work, given that we spend, you know, often huge chunks of time in the workplace, we're going to be miserable. And the other thing I think is that particularly pertinent now, given everything that's going on in the world, you know, there is a lot of anxiety, uncertainty about the future and what that's going to look like, and there are a lot of people feeling very stressed and very unhappy at the moment. You know, I when I wrote this book, things were slightly different on the world stage, but I think that when I talk about being happy, I think it's more pertinent now than ever.
Well, it's hard to go through change and go through family problems, and if there's an economic depression or something and you're not in a stable foundation, it'll be really difficult to get through troubled times, won't it?
It will be, yes. And I think what we do by human nature is we have a tendency to focus in on things that are causing us pain. You know, scientifically, that's harks back to the days when we lived in caves, and if we weren't careful, we would be somebody's dinner. So our brains are hardwired to look for potential threats. Our fight or flight response kicks in, and what can happen nowadays is that we spend a lot of time focusing on when things aren't going well for us, and our brains interpret those almost like a physical threat. So we can spend a lot of time really honing in on the things that are making us feel unhappy, miserable, and very, very unstable as well. So by refocusing and looking a bit more carefully, changing our perspective, Sarah, I think is the way to describe it. And that isn't about looking at the world through rose-colored glasses at all. It's about taking some time to appreciate what we've got and, you know, weighing things up for ourselves, really. You know, it can be a very difficult and challenging world out there. But, you know, for a lot of us, we have got more going for us than we perhaps might realize.
It's looking at what you have and being thankful for what you have, more of that concept, kind of getting back to the basics of life, or what you're taught maybe in religion and in other areas.
Being thankful for what we have. We forget what we have, Sarah. I think that's the first point I'd like to make here, is it's very easy to overlook, you know, what we have going for us in terms of our own personal strengths, but our own professional strengths as well. You know, I'm guessing most of the people that will be listening to this podcast have probably got jobs, probably got a roof over their head, probably have food on the table. But sometimes we have issues and problems that crop up very large, and we forget we have those things.
Just kind of ground yourself in what you have. Well, what stops us from being happiness other than for being happy, other than forgetting about our, you know, what we should be grateful for? Are there other things that we do to ourselves?
I think if you're not focused on being happy and your perspective is elsewhere, I think it's very easy to forget the things that make you happy. Sometimes it's about remembering the simplest things in life, you know, like going out for a walk, reconnecting with friends, picking up hobbies, you mentioned the word grounded and connected, those, you know, activities that really remind us who we are. Perhaps thinking back a few years to things we used to enjoy before we got on the treadmill of going to work and earning money. It's very easy to forget, and then you find that you're living a life that is somebody else, that's run by somebody else's expectations of you. And I think another thing that stops us from being happy is, and this is, I think, in my work with professional women a lot, is guilt. You know, taking time out for ourselves is something that's underestimated. And a lot of professional men and women work very, very long hours. And the thought of actually taking some time out for themselves and doing something they enjoy causes them huge amounts of guilt, because we're on this treadmill again. I should do this. I should be doing that. Well, you feel, which is a real shame.
Guilty because you have so many responsibilities. And if times get tough, or if you have mortgages to pay and you got kids in college, you feel guilty to do anything but focus on making that money and bringing in the bacon, right?
Exactly. But, you know, I'm married now, but I spent many, many years as a single mum. And one of my mantras then, Sarah, was a happy mum is a happy Josh. And I firmly believe that you cannot serve from an empty vessel, and you've got to fill yourself up first. You've got to look after yourself. You've got to make sure that you are fit and able to, you know, to serve your family, to serve the business community in which you work. And unless you're able to do that, then it's going to lead to burnout, you know, depression, anxiety, and eventually, you know, taking time off sick, which doesn't serve anybody well at all.
Well, you have a couple other chapters that I want to just pick out because the topics are really interesting. It's one is choose your seat wisely. Different cultures make a huge difference.
Yes.
Well, why does culture affect you so much, and how do you choose? What do you mean by all this?
Well, I wrote this particular chapter of the book when I was thinking about my experience as a teacher, my background's in education, and the school in which I worked at the time, Sarah, who you sat next to in the staff room really dictated the quality of your day. I think the culture that we have in the workplace can make or break you. And I think it's closely linked to this idea of happiness. You know, a lot of cultures in the workplace are very toxic. People, you know, don't live up to their values. They behave badly. We have a culture where people are not appreciated, where there is this, you know, you've got to be glued to your cell phone 24/7, and there is no respite and break from work. And there's a quote I came across a while ago that says, the culture of any organization is shaped by the worst behavior the leader is willing to tolerate. You know, there's a big responsibility for business leaders in the business community now to be thinking about, you know, staff well-being. I don't know what it's like over there in the States with you, Sarah, but well-being at work is a really hot topic over here at the moment in the UK. You know, we have some of the, you know, worst absentee rates that we've ever had. We have as a growing awareness of mental health issues at work, and your workplace can be instrumental in helping you to overcome those and to thrive at work.
Well, it costs corporations millions of dollars when people don't show up or are not able to focus and are unhealthy. But so now when is it that you say, okay, I don't like the people that I'm working with, they are toxic, and I need to find another job? You know, and sometimes people can't find another job in, you know, in a bad market. But when is it that you say, you know what, I'm not going to try to change this culture because it's just too hard. I'm going to jump into a culture that is just a lot healthier.
Exactly. I think you should do that as soon as you realize you're not happy. I think a surprising amount of people don't do that, though, Sarah, and they will stick somewhere where they're not happy for a variety of reasons. People are creatures of habit, aren't they? Change can be very difficult, very challenging. You know, there may be personal circumstances that keep them in a particular job or role. It might be location. You know, it's easy. The commute to work every day doesn't take too long. It could be there's a good paycheck at the end of it. You know, childcare issues may affect this as well. All of those things conspire to keep people in a situation where they can be really very unhappy. And personally, I'd say not enough people are prepared to take the risk and to make that move, which could make them unhappier. I think one of the things that really saddens me is when people hit, you know, middle age, their early 50s, and they realize that, you know, they may have not been desperately unhappy, but actually they've been living with a low grade level of unhappiness at work for years, and they turn around and they feel unfulfilled, almost as though they've wasted the last 10 or 20 years of their life. So I would say, you know, learn, first of all, understand what your values are, and are they being met at work? Open your eyes and look around you, and, you know, do a bit of a happiness audit. How fulfilled do you really feel in the job that you've got? And if the answer is not very, then start looking for something else.
And don't be afraid to do it. Just do it. And if the next job is bad too, then okay, find another one. Now, when is it that you start looking inward and saying it's your fault? You know, that I just can't work with anybody, or you know what I mean?
I think that's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, maybe your first thing you should ask yourself is, what's my contribution to this? And that's a no blame question. It's about sitting down and objectively looking at what's going on, and perhaps sitting down with, you know, with a coach or a mentor, or an accountability partner, somebody that you can talk things through and get a third party perspective on things. You know, are you contributing towards the situation? Because sometimes you might be. Sometimes you could be the person with the attitude problem. But equally, you might not be. And it could be, you know, for example, you may be working within an industry that just does not suit you. In which case, yeah, it's about making perhaps a bolder move. But really not being afraid to do it. One of my earliest mentors said to me when I moved overseas with my son, she said, "You've not done anything that can't be undone, Sue." And this is really true. It's not to say that undoing things may not always be the easiest, but it's a rare situation where you can't actually change again.
You can reboot your life at any time if you choose to, right? Now, what do you do, though, when you have all these bills, you have all these responsibilities, and you're making good money in a job, and it's hard to reboot your life at that point? You know, I mean, what do you do? How do you sell stuff? Do you downsize? I mean, what do you do?
I think here you've got a choice to make. There's a payoff, isn't there, Sarah? You know, you've got to look at, well, what am I getting from this current situation? I'm in a job I'm not particularly enjoying, and I'm unhappy. The other side of the coin to that is, actually, there's a great salary check at the end of the month. That, you know, there's great healthcare, there's childcare provision, it's within travelling distance. It enables me to pay the mortgage. And at some point, you've got to weigh up the payoff for you. If you weigh it up and you think, actually, despite all that, it really isn't what I want to do, and I want to make a change, then I'd say start by doing it small. So do a bit of research. Think about the kinds of things the alternatives, the things that you could be doing instead. So maybe seek out somebody who's already doing what you think you might like to do. Go and talk to them. What qualifications do you need? What's the salary structure like there? You know, what opportunities are there within that industry for you? Where could you see yourself in 2 years' time with it, maybe? Do you need to start doing some more qualifications? Do you perhaps need to go to night school? Often it's about not making changes overnight, or indeed changing everything. Is it possible to go down to part-time hours? There are lots of options open for you. You know, look at your outgoings and your living setup. Where can you make economies so that you don't need to be spending your whole paycheck every month, and you can begin to claw some money back and begin to build up perhaps a savings pot that would enable you to pursue alternatives. And, you know, with the internet, Sarah, you know, learning's never been easier and more accessible and more cost effective. And, you know, there's a massive growth, isn't there, of online businesses, online commerce, which you know, if you really are determined enough, you can build up a sideline business for yourself out of hours. You know, if you commit to say, okay, I'm going to stick with this job for the next 2 years, but I'm only going to do the minimum hours, you know, I'm not going to do any overtime. And on the side, I'm going to commit to developing, you know, perhaps a self-employed business and build it up that way. So there are lots of things you can do. This isn't about giving up, you know, your job and all your security overnight. That would, you know, depending on your personal circumstances, be a potentially foolish thing to do. Although I do think we need to take a few more risks in life sometimes.
But the point is to get started, right? Get started and be afraid to and do what you want to do. Your passion, you live once. Maybe you believe in reincarnation or something, but you live once. This is your life. Make the best of it and start now. Okay, you have something in your book that says definitely learn to accept difficult people, which I have a hard time with because I'd rather not learn to accept difficult people. If anybody's going to be difficult, it's going to be me, and I don't want to have to deal with you. No, I understand this, but okay. So how do we deal with difficult people?
Oh, well, you know, I think I remember, you know, when you remarked to me, you know, can't we just ignore them? Wouldn't life be wonderful if we could? Unfortunately, life's not like that. And, you know, my experience working with organizations of different sizes in different industries and with leaders, from leaders that are just at the beginning of their leadership career to senior execs sort of going into board level positions, is the toughest part of the job is the people part, not the actual operational side. Of people are people, and they come in all shapes and sizes, and they have different viewpoints from us. And, you know, unfortunately, we can't just ignore them. And particularly in the workplace, you know, we've got to learn to get along with people. Emotional intelligence is one of the keystones of great leadership. And I personally think people that we might label as difficult perhaps are people that lack emotional intelligence in some areas. The other thing I'd say is, you know, I talk about difficult people in the book, but I also label them, maybe they're just different. We all have different perspectives. No one's perspective is necessarily right or wrong. And sometimes when we call people difficult, we ourselves are having trouble understanding somebody else's viewpoint. And there is always the perspective that actually we could be the difficult one in this situation.
And it's being able to look at yourself and realizing, but what do you do with certain difficult people that there's somebody who just wants to take a screw to your side constantly? They're just a pain in the butt. No matter what you do, they're there to irritate you, bully you, do whatever they can to just be mean.
Yeah. I think, you know, in that case, if there is workplace bullying going on, or you feel victimized or got at, then I think that's a different kettle of fish. And that is the point at which you would go to, you know, the HR department, or you would go through the official channels at work if you felt that you were being bullied in any way, or somebody was behaving in a manner that made you feel very uncomfortable, that you were being victimized or treated unfairly in that sense. Definitely, well, I would go and speak to somebody.
But we have this situation now in the United States that if you, from a political standpoint, if you don't believe one side or the other, it's actually, it's kind of weird because it's, things are flipped. If you voted for Trump, a lot of people won't, I mean, there's a lot of abuse. Like, they won't even, people are losing friendships over it and all sorts of things. And usually you would think that it was the opposite way, you know, like religious people are closed-minded sometimes with people who aren't, but it's not that. It's like, if you voted for Trump or if you are religious or you, all these things, it's becoming really hard to deal with. How do people get through that, and how do they let go and say,
okay, this is not appropriate. First of all, in the workplace, we shouldn't even be talking about politics. But second of all,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, that's why we vote. That's why voting is private, so that you can believe whatever you want and people need to leave you alone.
They do. And I think, you know, again, with the rise of social media, I love social media. But what it has given is given people a platform to air their views in public. So you're quite right. You know, 20 years ago, all this stuff was private. We wouldn't know what the person sitting next to us at work necessarily thought, or how they voted, or any of their views. But now it's all out there for everybody to see. And I think you're quite right. You know, in the workplace, it's not a place to be discussing politics or religion as well, in my view. And, you know, let's tie this back in with that question you asked me earlier about culture. It's the responsibility of the leader to really step up and lead here and say, right, hold on. You know, before this, we all got along okay. Let's go back and let's reconnect to what it is we're doing here and what we appreciate about each other. Healthy debate is a good thing, but bullying debate isn't. And I think we have to be really mindful of that and guard against it and protect each other as well. You know, there may well be people around that are feeling quite vulnerable, you know, in either camp, and that's not fair. Tolerance, Sarah, I think is the word here. We need to be, we all need to perhaps learn to be slightly more tolerant of each other, and you know, maybe not so quick to air our views about everything we think. Not everything we think has to come out of our mouths, and you know, certainly in the workplace.
Right? I mean, politics and religion, don't talk about it because it's going to cause issues. Now it's all over the place. And, you know, you see, like I said, people losing friends. My daughter, my daughter's Hispanic. My husband's from Mexico. And some of the comments that she hears about the wall and stuff, I mean, whatever you believe in the wall, but some of the rude comments that she hears, you know, about go back to, you know, over the wall and stuff. Wait a minute. She's born here.
Yeah.
You know, she's only spent maybe a week visiting down there. So come on. But, you know,
I know. It's, you know, people really need to take a step back and, you know, rein themselves in. We've got a similar thing over here, Sarah. You know, we've had the Brexit referendum and, you know, there are people from Europe living in the UK who've lived and worked here for many years who are experiencing a very similar thing. And it's not right. And this again ties in, you know, with what I said a minute ago about emotional intelligence. You know, control yourself. Just because you think it does not mean it has to come out of your mouth. And I think there are sections of society that really need to take that message on board and manage themselves much more firmly.
Well, the amazing part is it depends on where you get your news and what you watch, because I feel like I'm in a completely different world from a lot of other people. I'm like, how could you even have some of those paradigms? You know, I'd say, I just can't even, you know, I watch and listen to a lot of alternative. I listen to media from all perspective as much as I possibly can, but I see these extreme paradigms from all these different things. And like, if you're only, you know, cause with social media and with media, they're getting fed the same stuff that keeps validating their opinions. Next thing you know, you got people who are really extreme. And it's very interesting. And no matter what you say, they won't even listen to it. So, because everything they read and everything they see validates what they believe. And it becomes this, it's really interesting. It's a really interesting situation that we're
interesting.
In.
Yeah. Interesting is one word. I think potentially quite frightening, because as you say, those types of people are not up for debate. And they're, you know, the normal course of things, people might hold an opinion. You could have a reasoned debate with them and attempt to help them see your point of view, and they may encourage you to see their point of view. However, there are a certain set of people who are just really moving down one track and only looking at things through a very, very narrow lens. And, you know, that can, I think that can feel quite frightening.
Yeah. And it's, I think we're in a place where we have, you know, quite a bit of our population probably isn't very educated. You know, our schools aren't doing that great. We have elite schools that are doing wonderful, right? You always have, you know, the top 10% are doing amazing. We have great universities, but the mass-oriented schools aren't really doing that great of a job. And we have a culture that isn't really valuing learning. So we have a lot of people that are easily manipulated by whatever agenda that is trying to happen. And it turns it into a very difficult subject when you have, when you're trying to get them to critically think. It's a, it's an interesting time, I can say.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Well, I agree with you.
Well, let's move on, because you have this put the magic wand away. What does that mean?
Rightio. Well, I'm very much of the opinion, Sarah, that success doesn't just fall in our lap. And I think this, for me, is very much about recognizing your own successes, your own achievements, your own strengths, and owning them. And it's about, you know, on social media, you know, certain people may like to paint their life as being just one huge swathe of success. And it's very easy to look at people and get the impression that, you know, they've been really lucky and everything just happens for them. But that's really not the case. And for me, success isn't about waving a magic wand. It's about taking responsibility for our own lives and the outcomes, not leaving it to chance or the universe, is quite a popular view. But it's about being committed, dedicated, having a focus, acting intentionally, having a plan for your future, and not just leaving it to chance. I once gave a talk at a networking group, and I asked everybody in the room to write down three things they'd achieved that week. And I had a sea, and these were all business people, I had a sea of blank faces looking at me, because none of them could identify with the word achievement. And in the end, I said to them, write down three things you've done this week. And that was okay. And I led a discussion then about helping us to see, you know, our we do things every day that are achievements every day. And just because they're not feeding the poor and hungry of the world or solving the world's triple dip recession and financial crisis doesn't mean they're not achievements. We live our lives on a much smaller scale by and large. I certainly do, and most people I know do. And it's about looking at your life and noticing and appreciating where you have played an active role in your success. So when I talk about put that magic wand away, you know, success does just not happen for us. We've got to be resourceful. We've got to be resilient. You know, sometimes timing plays a part, but our success is largely down to every exam we've ever taken, every interview we've ever turned up for, every job we've taken, every person we've ever talked to in our network, every connection we've ever made. None of that's down to luck at all. It's down to us.
Well, isn't it more important to enjoy the journey instead of always looking at where you are? Because otherwise, you're never going to be happy.
I think you've got to have a mix. Certainly enjoying where you are now, but I would say if you are ambitious and, you know, you work in an organization or in an industry and you want to drive your career forward, then you need to be looking at the next step above you and planning for it, if that is what you want. But you've got to balance that, yes, against actually taking some time to enjoy where you are. And, you know, to take us right back to the point we talked about at the beginning, notice what's going on around you and enjoy that. So it's getting the balance right, Sarah.
But if you want to be captain of the industry and work your way up to the top, you have to enjoy the process of competing to get there, right? I mean, you have to love the competition of getting there. If you want to solve, you know, the dollar crisis, you can't just, you're a complete failure if the dollar crisis doesn't get solved. I mean, you have to enjoy the challenge of it. Otherwise, if you never make your goal, then you have to put your goal, I think, you put your goal way out there and of whatever, you need small goals too. But if you put your goal way out there and you're always trying to get there, you have to enjoy the challenge of it. Otherwise, I don't know. That's just my opinion. Otherwise, I don't think you're only happy for that split second when you make the goal. Got to be happy along the way.
Yeah,
right?
You've got to. You have to be. You've got to. Yeah, you do. You've got to enjoy the process of it. And if you don't, then you know, I question why. Why are you doing it? You know, what's the point if you're not actively engaged in the process and you don't enjoy the journey of it and you don't enjoy those things? You're not going to be successful. Your heart won't be in it. You're not going to be aligned to your success. And it's going to be meaningless for you. You know, and I think the people that do end up at the, you know, the top of their careers are people who have that passion, who can see the end goal and have that passion and engage with it every step.
Well, and maybe you're always looking towards, you know, the future of trying to do something else. But I think that, you know, so many people that want to lead a company or move up the ladder. See, I'm out of that scenario. I don't work in big companies anymore. I run all my own entrepreneurial stuff for a reason. I ran a company and built a company for 10 years, but I did spend a good chunk of time in telecommunications industry and large companies. But I mean, you have to enjoy that whole grind and competition thing. I don't know. Well, to move on.
You do.
You do. You have to love that. Okay, but what's imposter syndrome? What is that?
Imposter syndrome is it's an extreme form of self-doubt, and it's characterized by very successful people seeing themselves as a fake and a fraud and feeling that they're going to be found out, that they don't deserve their success, that they're only in the position they're in because other people have mistakenly and foolishly seen something in them that's not really there. And they spend their professional time waiting for that tap on the shoulder to say, "We've got you. You shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be sitting in that seat." It's been recognized since the late 1970s. It was a term coined by two psychologists, Clance and Imes, and they noticed it. They were working with high-flying female execs, and they couldn't understand why these women got so far in their career but then stalled. And some characteristics of it are perfectionism. So you will go so far, but you won't ever complete a piece of work because you don't think it's good enough. And that acts as a way of stopping you from taking that step to sort of put your head above the parapet, as it were. You may not therefore put yourself forward for opportunities. You will always see that other people are far more worthy than yourself. It's not the same as not having confidence, because people who suffer from imposterism are, by anybody's standards, successful. But it's about not maintaining that progress. I would say, Sarah, it's the single most common thing that I talk about to clients when I work with leaders and executives on a one-to-one basis. People who are in, you know, really very senior roles and who can't believe they're there and just do not believe they deserve to be there. And as a result, they are really suffering and self-sabotaging themselves. It's very common. I was reading an article a while ago, and it said something like 70%.
For both men and women. Keep going.
Sorry. For both men and women, Yeah, the original research was done on women. However, recent research has shown that it affects men and women equally, and up to 70% of the workforce have reported from suffering from those feelings, which can literally stop you in your tracks.
Why? Why are so many people thinking they're less valuable than that? I mean, what is the deal with that?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things is it's very common in people who take up new positions. Whenever we do something new, it feels uncomfortable, doesn't it? You get that period of change. And for those people, they mistake, I think, that uncomfortableness that comes with change, and they begin to doubt themselves. Am I any good at this? A lot of people compare themselves to somebody else, so they may be in a new role, and it may be a role they've had, you know, limited experience of before, and they look around and they see others that are very confident, very comfortable, getting to grips with what they're doing, and they measure themselves against those people, and they find themselves sadly lacking. So one of the ways to deal with it is to understand that when you're new at something, at whatever level of seniority that might be, it is going to be a period of change, and it's going to be uncomfortable, and there are going to be things that you don't know how to do. The research has also shown that it's very common in what they call first generation professionals. So people from families where they may be the first one to go to university. So if you've not come from that background where higher education is expected of you, and you're the first one in your family to go to university, often with that comes feeling that you don't deserve to be on that boardroom table sitting there, because again, you'll be busy comparing yourself to people who may have come from, you know, families. This is all perception, Sarah, you know, families that have this tradition of university type education, and it can prompt feelings like, what am I doing sitting here? And that is a large part of the work that I do with people is helping them to overcome those feelings.
Well, it's just so interesting. Is it part of they think that what they're doing is they've got it so worked up into their brain that it's such a big deal, and then they get there and they just don't feel that they're good enough, versus putting everything into perspective of, I guess it's hard for me to understand, because I keep going through it and I think, oh, that's not that big of a deal after I get to understand it. And I, you know, I'm almost the opposite way of thinking, oh, that's not that. But I think people get it worked up into their brain that it's a bigger deal than what it is.
Yep, they do. They do. And you use the phrase there, they think they're not good enough. And they do. You know, it is, as I said at the beginning, an extreme form of self-doubt. It's a form of anxiety. They fear that they don't hold on to their notion of success, and they feel that they can't replicate it. So I'm currently writing a second book about raising your profile in the workplace. And I interviewed a university professor here in the UK. She used to be a judge. She's a tremendously academic, very bright, very, very capable woman. And she said to me, you know, she said, every time I've taken a step up in my career, she said, when I became a judge, I didn't think I could do that. When I became a university professor, I didn't think I can do that. It can happen to any of us at any time. I envy you, Sarah, never having those feelings. That, you know, that's what I aspire to for my clients and people that I work with, that they have that complete self-assurance. And that's what it is. It's real self-assurance, self-worth, self-belief, that you deserve to be there, that things are not a big deal, you can cope with whatever is thrown at you. And for some people, that just takes a little longer to get used to, and, you know, learn to manage. For some people, it's about managing those feelings on an ongoing basis rather than eradicating them all the time. I think if you're given to, you know, self-doubt, it's something that may well crop up for you on more than one occasion.
Well, I'm not like that at all. I mean, that's good. If I'm going into something where I know I don't know what I'm doing and I'm supposed to be doing it, I'm honest, I don't know what I'm doing, but I have enough confidence to go, well, if I do this long enough, I know I'll figure it out and I'll learn it. And you know what I mean? I'm in this spot and I don't know. I'm an idiot. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing, but give me time and I'll be good at it. So that's how, you know, that's how I feel about stuff. But so don't get me wrong. There are times I feel like an idiot.
Yeah, I think that's a great attitude. And with imposter syndrome, it occurs with people when they've got the job because, you know, their CV has shown they can do it. The interview panel has every faith in them. And actually, they can do it. But it's that internal monologue that won't be quiet, that won't shut down, that's telling them, that little voice that's in their ear saying, what are you doing here? You know, why on earth have they given you this job? And it is literally coming from internally. It's not that they, in most cases, they can't do the job. It's that voice of dissent, that internal voice of dissent that's causing them to doubt themselves.
Well, you know, that's why I love teaching at the university. And I coached kids for 15 years in sports. And my goal was always to really build their confidence. What I noticed is that if you believe, it's amazing how much more you can do. It's people putting that, whether you're doing it to yourself or whether people are doing it to you, the thought of you just don't think you can do it. But once you think you can do it, it's amazing what you actually can do. It's absolutely amazing. You have to turn that switch. And sure, when it comes to sports, you might have that attitude that you can do it and you still might lose because you don't have the skill. But the difference is I can do this. If I learn that, then I really can do it. You know what I mean? It's just a matter of time. Okay, well, I can do this. And it's that same attitude of always, if you don't want to do it, that's different. You know, I don't like this. Well, if I liked it, I could do it. I don't want to do it. That's a different situation.
Yeah. I mean, you described something there that's very similar to an idea called having a growth mindset. I don't know if you've come across the work of Carol Dweck. She talks about having a growth and a fixed mindset. And a growth mindset is just like you've described, where you don't define yourself in terms of, you know, your intelligence, your smarts, rather it is you are somebody who is, you know, resilient, you can overcome challenges, you're a problem solver. And it's those qualities that enable you to succeed. Research has shown when we view ourselves solely through the lens of how intelligent we are, the time will come when we meet an obstacle that we can't overcome because we don't have those problem solving skills, and we can't learn something. We can't learn something new. So I completely agree with you. You know, giving young people the gift of self-esteem, self-worth, self-confidence is the biggest gift you can bestow upon them, and developing that in young people will set them up for life. It really will.
Well, and that's why, to me, the culture is such, if you're not in a culture that accepts that kind of thinking, you know, because I've been in cultures where you just can't, the culture won't, and if you are that way, they just want to beat you down. To me, that's where I want to run from, places like that. And then when you're in cultures that all thrive on that, it's like, wow, we can do anything. It's like you're flying. But, you know, of course, there's cultures all in between that spectrum. And if you're so lucky to get into that thriving culture, that's where you want to stay. It's like where everybody has that attitude.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Exactly. And if you're not, Sarah, I completely agree with you. You need to get your running shoes on, and you need to get out of there as quickly as you can. You really do.
And that's what that's where all the inventions and innovation and all sorts of stuff come from. Once you can free your mind and you can say, I can do this and I'm going to do all these things, that's where magic happens, in my opinion. I mean, on all fronts. So I had a futurist that came on earlier this week, And he calls that being in the quantum energy, you know, being in the quantum thinking field when you can be like that. And I,
right.
It is, it's a really cool place. But you also talk about, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say to you that, you know, I moved to Southeast Asia with my son when he was 9 and I was a single mum. I moved to Borneo with him. And that was very much the mindset that I had that enabled me to give up a job and everything that went with it and just make a complete change. This belief that actually I can do it. I can do anything I set my mind to. And that is a really important lesson that my son's absorbed as well.
Yeah, I love it when you can get the kids to absorb that. So you talk about communicating powerfully. How do you communicate powerfully, and how do you teach yourself to do that?
Okay, so when I talk about communicating powerfully, really what's underpinning that is showing up in a way that allows your true potential to really shine through. And that's a combination of how you communicate verbally, but how you communicate with your body and your physiology as well. So, you know, again, this is a large part of the work that I do when I work with clients on an individual basis is to help them make these sometimes just very subtle changes that will really affect how other people experience them. Certainly, if you are ambitious and you have, you know, leadership aspirations, or you are an exec and you want to take that next step up, often it's about changing your verbal communications to ensure that you are concise, you're clear, and you're confident. Part of this is getting rid of what we call fillers, the ums and the ahs between words when we're talking. There's something called uptalk, which is when the end of your sentences rise and it makes you sound as though you're asking questions all the time. And it can have the effect of making you sound unsure of yourself and inexperienced. And it's sometimes prevalent in young adults. The other part of it, of course, is your physical presence, how you show up and what you communicate without even opening your mouth. And that can be something as simple as changing the way that you stand, changing the way that you walk into a room so that you have open, upright body language and you're making eye contact with people. And I come across a surprising number of, again, young adults who find it difficult to make eye contact. Now, this can vary according to culture, but certainly the Western culture that I do most of my work within, making eye contact is seen as a positive thing and a mark of respect and connecting with somebody. So it's important that you're able to do that. But all this really stems, it comes back to this confidence thing again, Sarah, about feeling okay about who you are inside and understanding that you've got a right to be there. You've got a right to walk into that room. You've got a right to be sitting at the table. And if you don't, then that is going to show up in your body language and how you communicate with people. It's also to do with deciding what your message is and being flexible in how you communicate so that your message is got across to the other person in the way that you intended it to as well. So that's about observing the person in front of you, looking at their communication style. An example of this is many years ago, I was talking to a head teacher I was doing some work with, and I could tell he was looking really impatient with me and quite irritable. And I realized that I'd gone into a long rambling story, and actually his communication style was very short, sharp and sweet, and he just wanted the bare facts, no embroidery whatsoever, no embellishment. And I immediately stopped in my tracks and changed, just gave him what he needed. And after, it was a very salient point for me. And so when I talk about communicating powerfully, it's also about making sure you deliver your message in a way that suits the other person and their communication style as well. And that's best done by observing and by listening as well.
Yeah, and listening is also watching how their body language, right? Which is what you did. He wanted wanted short and sweet and get out of here because he's busy. And you were, and I do that sometimes too. I just feel like talking, and all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, okay. Because I can be short and sweet. I might be short and mean sometimes, but I can be short and sweet. But sometimes I just like to talk a lot. Okay. But that's not because I'm not confident. That's because I'm probably not aware of what I'm doing. I'm just Okay. Well, well, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed this. And I hope you had, you know, with all the craziness going on there with Brexit and all the stuff you guys have going on, you're in your own little craziness. We have our own craziness over here. So you'll probably have a ton of work to do. Do you work in the United States too?
I do Skype sessions. I've never been across in person yet to run workshops or anything, but I do a lot of my one-to-one work via Skype. So, so yes, I do speak to people in the States as well.
And then you have your book that you're selling on how to be strategies for being brilliant, 21 ways to be happy, confident, and successful. And how can they get your stuff?
Yes. Go to Amazon, and you can download the Kindle version. It's not for sale as a paperback on Amazon.com, but you can get the Kindle version on Amazon.com, Sarah.
Can they get the paper version on your site, or is it just...
If you really want the paper version, people can email me, and I can pop a paper version in the post to them. So that can be arranged.
Okay, so good. And you have other books too, right? Or is this your first? You have more books, right?
This is the first one. I'm currently writing a book at the moment, and that's about it's aimed at emerging leaders, and it's aimed at helping them to understand techniques and tools to learn to raise their profile at work so that they're not their organization or industry's best kept secret. Being good at what you do just isn't good enough in the workplace these days, Sarah, is it? So you've got to be able to share your skills, your talents, and your successes in a way that you're comfortable with and doesn't feel like you're showing off or bragging, which stops a lot of people from doing that. So yeah,
that's the hard part, and especially with women, is if you talk about being good, you people look down upon. It's hard because I'll just, you know, I'm very comfortable around men, and so when I'm around women, I'll talk like I'm, you know, whatever, and they don't like that, and so it's a struggle. It's you're judged more harshly, which is I don't like that. I don't like that.
No, I don't either. I don't either.
Can't I just talk? I know we all have those struggles, but okay. Well, thank you. And I'll have your information up on the radio page and we'll go from there. And thank you so much. It's nighttime over there in England, right? So you're getting ready to go to bed. Okay.
Well, not quite. It's approaching dinner time, but Sarah, thank you very much.
Okay. You're welcome. And have a great night.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Susan Ritchie, and hopefully you'll heed some of that advice on how can you become happier, in turn help your family become happier and be better at pursuing what you have passion about in life. Because at the end of the day, that's what's important, right? Is doing what makes you and your family happy. But I want to remind you to tune into the Pizzagate Part 2 episode that I have on Wednesday. And it's about the reality of sexual abuse in our country. This time, I'm going to have FBI spokesman Jeffrey Van Nest is going to come on. He's going to talk about how the FBI goes after child sex traffickers and how they approach it, what groups they go after, just the whole reality of the situation. And I also want to encourage you to please share the part one and part two of these stories with your family, friends, whoever. You can go on my YouTube channel and share it, or the podcast, you can share it, tweet it, whatever. It's so important that people realize how much of an epidemic this is.
So please tune in, please share and pass that out to others. And for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. As Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.